Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast. If you're looking for the most in-depth insight into the world of downhill and enduro mountain biking, then this is the podcast for you. For all the links mentioned on this and every episode of the podcast, you can find them at downtimepodcast.com. While you're there, make sure you subscribe to the show because not all of our episodes are available on other websites. It's totally free and it means you'll get each episode as soon as it drops. There's a subscribe page on the website to help you get it done. If you want to support what I'm doing and show that you're part of an ever-growing crew of riders who are listening to the podcast, learning from our guests and getting faster on your bike, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. You'll find t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts and mugs. All proceeds go towards growing and improving the podcast, and shipping is free worldwide on orders over £30. Other ways you can help are to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen and tell your friends about the show. Also, I want to say a massive thanks to everyone who's been out there spreading the word and helping us grow. You can also give us a follow on social media by searching for Downtime Podcasts. This week's episode is supported by Liat, and I'm going to be talking to the main man, Chris Liat. If you want to find out more about what they're doing, then head over to liat.com. That's L-E-A-T-T.com. In this episode, we're going to be chatting about the Liat neck brace, finding out more about Chris's motivation to design it in the first place, what it took to get the product to market, how it's tested, and also chat about some of the concerns that people have around the brace damaging other parts of the body during a crash. We'll also be chatting a bit about helmet technology and where that's going. I definitely learned a lot from this one, and I hope you do too. So, without further ado, here's Chris Liat. Chris Liat, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking some time out of your day for a chat.
Thanks, Chris.
Good stuff. So let's start from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your background and where you grew up.
Thanks. I'm born and bred South African, lived in Cape Town for most of my life and went to school here, have traveled extensively throughout my life, but always seemed to find my way back to South Africa again. And this is where I call home. Our office is based in a place called Durbanville, which is the beginning of a wine-growing region in South Africa, just outside Cape Town. And that's where South African Liat headquarters are.
Okay. So is the headquarters of Liat globally now, yeah?
So most of the management structure is based in South Africa. Both myself and our CEO, Sean McDonald, are based in this office. And so is our design team, the Liat Lab, our logistics, legal, finance is all based here. Our biggest footprint will be in California in terms of our warehouse and sales facility. But South Africa is our control hub, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. And what's your role at Liat now? What's your kind of job title?
So I've gone from right in the beginning wearing many hats to being now, I guess, the founder and chairman of the board. And my particular interest is research and development and ongoing efforts in that regard. So I spend most of my time on new product development and lab-related issues where I have a very good CEO in place and a really good management team who run the business on a day-to-day basis.
Awesome. Good stuff. We'll come back to Liat for sure. But I think motorbikes have been a really influential part of your life and a big part of it. How did you get into the motorbike side of things?
So motorcycles have been an important part of my life where they've occupied many, many pleasurable hours, slightly less when I was studying medicine and slightly more when I had any time free to pursue motorcycles. For me, it really started at school where some of the kids in my class used to come to school on 50cc motorbikes, and I thought these were just the coolest thing. I couldn't afford one, so I had a bit of motorcycle envy at a young age. And I went to go to watch some short circuit racing at Killarney, which is a local raceway, and really enjoyed it and ended up helping a friend of mine in the pits for a while. And at a point at the end of a year when I was 16 going on 17, there was a newcomer's race and I got to ride and I was completely and utterly hooked. So much so that At the end of that year, my parents and my sister were planning a trip to the US, and I begged them to give me the money they would have spent on my part of the trip to buy a motorcycle and go racing. And kudos to my parents. They weren't terribly happy about the idea. And after putting one barrier in place, they actually agreed to do just that. And looking back, the barrier was quite an interesting one, given the course of my life evolved. My dad said to me, if you want to race motorcycles, you need to know what happens when you fall off them. So I'm going to arrange for you to do ward rounds at a local spinal hospital. And if you still want to ride motorbikes after having been on a few ward rounds, then you can have the money. And so that's what I did. I went to a spinal unit in Cape Town and wasn't deterred, as one isn't at that young age, by the carnage and injuries that can happen as a result of riding motorcycles. And bought a motorcycle, a Yamaha RZ50 from the current Western Province, which is the region I live in, champion, Greg Dreyer. And I started racing motorcycles. Absolutely, yeah, loved it. And that was the start of a long journey for me.
Awesome. Yeah, and the medical side of things, that was your career earlier on, right? So you found your way into the medical world. What got you interested in that?
So my stint in the spinal unit didn't have a huge impact on my life at that point in time. But I think on reflection, it must have been in the back of my mind. In South Africa, when I finished school, you had to do a compulsory 2 years national service in the Defence Force. And I was called up just by chance to the South African Medical Services, which is the medical corps within the South African National Defence Force. And in the second year of my national service, I was placed at a marine or maritime medical centre in Simonstown in Cape Town. And I got to spend some time with some really cool national service doctors who sort of showed an interest in my interest in medicine. And I used to assist in theatre with minor procedures, and I absolutely fell in love with medicine. So I went back to school to rewrite my final year to get the marks I needed to get into medical school. And then went to the University of Cape Town to do my medical degree, and then actually did my internship in the United Kingdom before coming back to South Africa, and then spending a few years doing a number of different specialities, which is quite typical of a new doctor until you really figure out what it is you want to do and you've got a bit of experience under your belt. And then I went to Tygerberg Hospital as a neurosurgical resident, to specialize in neurosurgery. And it was halfway through my residency that and this can't be a typical thing, I said to my professor, I want to take 1 year out of my residency to pursue a business idea that everybody had said to me I really should pursue. And I guess business idea at that stage, maybe even an over-exaggeration, I was trying to solve a problem. And it was all about solving the problem in the beginning. And that's what I spent this year off doing. And, of course, that was 15 years ago, and I've never been back to medicine.
And what was it that inspired you to take that year out and to start looking at the brace?
So my son, who was 4 at the time, had 2 weeks prior to an event we went to together ridden a motorcycle for the first time. And he absolutely loved it, tore off down the road and fell off into a bush. And he was, I think, as excited about the prospect of riding motorbikes as I was. But because I was a resident at the time and working very hard, I wasn't riding terribly much. And on a post-call day, I went to watch an endurance event. And I happened to be sitting next to a paramedic who I used to see from time to time in the hospital environment. And one of the riders came down a mountain and said another rider had fallen off, a guy by the name of Alan Selby, and he wasn't in a good state, and you know, can we go up the mountain and go and assist him? So the paramedic asked me to join him, and we went up in a four-wheel drive vehicle, and we found Alan, and it looked like he had gone over the handlebars and injured his neck. Fortunately, we had all the resuscitation equipment with us, and I intubated him, you know, protected his airway, did CPR, administered all the drugs in that protocol a few times, and unfortunately, he didn't survive. We then brought him down the mountain and had to tell his family, which is obviously devastating. And the whole time, my son Matthew was with me, and that was sort of a key moment in my life where I said to myself, "I can't allow my son to ride if this is the potential outcome." And I guess that's where the thinking on the neck brace started.
Yeah, super powerful stuff. So you've had that event. It's got you thinking. You've been to your boss and said you'd like to take a year out. Where do you go from there?
So, yeah, a lot of enthusiasm and not a lot of skill in terms of developing a product or even a prototype. So the way I started was looking at, from an academic perspective, how people break their necks and what type of neck injuries are suffered by motorcyclists, and the same is true of bicycle riding, for example, downhill, where you fall over the handlebars and you land on your head with the weight of your torso compressing your neck. So I developed a thesis around what I thought was the way to prevent these type of injuries by looking at the classification, the incidence, the severity of motorcycle-related falls. And taking this thesis, I now needed to produce a prototype, which was, I guess, one half of the equation to see if I could make something that was wearable. Of course, there's no good in having protection if it's unwearable. So the trick was to develop something that was wearable in terms of physical prototype, and at the same time develop a test method to ensure that this product was actually going to do what I thought it was going to do, and as importantly, not do any harm. And so at that point in time, I reached out to a few people in terms of somebody who had the skill to build a model for me, make a mold and produce a few prototypes that we could then test with. And so I approached a downhill bicycle rider, Mark Hopkins, and together in his workshop, we produced the first few prototypes. I must say, right in the beginning, I had an idea of what the brace, how the brace would function, and not a really clear idea of how it would look ultimately. And the trick was to produce a surface that the helmet was in contact with and couldn't extend over. So the first prototype I produced was one of plastic and foam, which I built around my father's neck. And the second one I produced around my wife's neck by using a foil to dissipate the heat away from her, and using Bondo or body filler from the automotive environment to produce a first sort of really rough mold I can sculpt on her. And then I think Mark at that point in time thought I was particularly mad with this really odd-shaped piece of body filler that I wanted to turn into a product. So he helped me make the first mold and the first few prototypes, and I was then able to take those prototypes and put them on a number of riders, myself being the first one, in terms of the fit, form, and function. Could you actually wear this device around your neck and still ride a motorcycle? Of course, that's one half of the equation. The next challenge was to test it from a scientific perspective to see if it actually did reduce neck injuries. And that was probably even more challenging, because at the time, there were no standards. At the time, the only real test dummies that were freely available were the ones used by the automotive industry, the hybrid three, the typical hybrid three crash test dummy. But what these dummies were designed to do was to measure neck tension forces. So if you're sitting in a car with a seatbelt over your shoulder and you're in an impact, your head and neck want to elongate. Whereas if you fall off a motorcycle, essentially the force is going from the ground to your helmet and then it's transferred via your helmet to your skull base, to your neck, and to the rest of your torso. But all that force is going through your neck. And in the scenario where you're wearing a brace, the force is going from the ground to the helmet. The helmet then rotates and touches the brace and goes from the helmet to the brace to the rest of your body and in a degree bypasses your neck. And that degree of bypassing your neck is the quantum or the size of force reduction through the neck. So it was a real challenge, and we did a number of calculations in terms of mathematical calculations. We then looked for a mathematical surrogate, so a computer model that would model a neck injury in compression rather than extension, which is the way that most tests were conducted. We built some models to understand the head movement dynamic in an impact. And around this time, I was approached by BMW in Germany to bring what I had developed to date to Germany, and together with KTM work on this project and allow them to test it in their lab. And of course, I jumped at the opportunity because they had a whole lot more equipment than we did. And we designed a series of tests, or they designed a series of tests to test the neck brace. And quite interestingly at the time, because, which is once again an unusual collaboration between BMW and KTM, in the Dakar rallies, there were a huge number of neck injuries and fatalities from riders going over the handlebars or hitting camel grass and impacting their heads into the instrument cluster on the motorcycle and breaking their necks. So both companies really wanted to solve the problem. There was a spate where there was at least one high-profile death a year in the Dakar from neck injuries. So they were both invested in finding a solution and had called upon anybody who had any ideas to bring them to test. I was very fortunate in that I was present during the testing. And because we'd done a lot of computer modeling, I could predict fairly accurately what would work and what wouldn't work and what sort of forces were going to be seen in the tests. So at BMW, we did quite a lot of testing. We did static pull tests where the dummy was strapped down and a cord was tied to the helmet and the helmet was pulled against the brace. We did dynamic tests where the dummy with the brace in place was dropped or impacted onto a surface that would cause the head to move in a direction and impact the brace. And through this group of tests that had been devised at BMW, we showed quite clearly that there was a reduction in neck forces using the Liat brace. And some of the other inventions that were present for this testing period, which included straps and devices that were attached to the helmet, didn't show favorable results. In fact, in certain instances, actually increased neck forces. And that's when the collaboration started, and that's when we understood that the brace could be effective. And they also helped a little bit with the styling and commentary on sort of the ergonomics of the brace, so that the early neck braces that were produced for sale in some part had a bit of KTM and BMW in them.
Yeah. This sounds like a lot of work for a year. Are we still in the year out or have things got a bit crazy?
Yeah. So you're quite right. My request to my professor of a year out turned into, I think at that stage it was about three. And as I think I mentioned earlier, I haven't gone back to medicine since. So it became a full-time pursuit.
And so how are you funding that? Because, I mean, development of a product is not a cheap thing to do.
It isn't. It always takes longer and costs more than you anticipate. So initially it was sort of self-funding of early prototypes. And then we went to friends and family and said, you know, we think we can sell neck braces if they are effective and wearable. And we got a lot of riders in Cape Town and friends and family to put money into the business as seed capital. And our offer was that on the back of that, they would receive shares in the ultimate company. And that's what we did. And it was really good in the sense that from when we started selling braces, we've been self-funding. So we haven't had to go to the market again and look for funding, that we had enough funding to bring the product into fruition and go through the whole industrialization, commercialization of the neck brace and then bring it to market. And of course, some quite interesting things happened along the way to make the brace as popular as it is.
Yeah, so you obviously got some good positive results out of the testing with KTM and BMW. What sort of magnitude of reduction are you seeing in those tests in the forces on the neck?
So that's a good question and a difficult question to answer. One of the ways to answer medical questions is it depends. So it depends on the velocity of the impact, the trajectory of the head, and the type of force. So there are various forces at play. For example, there's either tension or compression. There's either flexion or extension, which we call bending moments, or torque, as you would understand from a sort of a motorcycle car environment. And there's also translational forces, where the one moves backwards or forwards relative to the other. But we, in developing and testing the neck brace, develop a model where we use injury criteria and in the early days, something called an NIJ, which is a composite value. It looks at all the different forces at any point in time over an impact sequence to understand whether you're actually increasing or decreasing the risk of injury to the neck. So depending on the circumstances, you know, you can get a 20% reduction in neck injury likelihood or a 60% reduction in neck injury likelihood. Like everything, there is a point at which the system will fail, like a seatbelt, like a helmet. But if you look at the impact dynamics at play in most accidents, it's raising that bar so that the vast majority of people never get to an injury threshold. So you may reduce the forces by, say, 30%, but that 30% reduction in forces means that people are far less likely to get to that injury threshold. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, that makes sense, definitely. And I've heard kind of concerns from people saying, well, surely, that energy is going somewhere. Is it not just going to cause an injury further down the spine? Mm. Is that the case, or is the load kind of spread out by the brace?
So that's a very good question. And I'll start off by saying that there is definitely a difference in energy flow. And if we look at a pendulum test where we take a dummy with a brace on versus a dummy without a brace on, and we invert it and swing it into a stationary surface which mimics a fall, you can actually see that whatever we're swinging it into gets knocked further out of the way when you're wearing a neck brace. In other words, the energy that was being absorbed by the neck is now being displaced into the ground or into the block and into the rest of the torso. And so the thesis of the brace is to create an alternative load path. So instead of the force going from the head down the neck, the force goes from the head to other body structures, your trapezius muscles, your sternum, the paraspinal muscles, the big muscles on your back, and bypasses the neck. So if you're having a lower force in the neck, that force, the magnitude of the force being transferred down the rest of the spine is actually also lower. When we test the neck brace and when we run models and when we set up different simulations, we never just look at the neck in isolation. We look at everything. So the head is instrumented, the neck is instrumented, the spine is instrumented, the collarbones are instrumented. So we can understand where the force is going. And interestingly enough, back forces or thoracic spine forces are lower with a neck brace on than without a neck brace on.
Okay. So is there any kind of increased risk to any other areas of the body when you're wearing a brace, or is the likelihood of injury in the neck and other areas lower overall?
It's lower overall. So okay. what we do is we look at the likelihood of an injury in different body structures when we test the neck brace. So for example, and one of the topical areas for discussion around neck braces is they break collarbones. And, well, I guess if it breaks your collarbone but it saved my neck, that transference of force to my collarbone, I'd rather have a broken collarbone than a broken neck. In fact, that's not the case, and I'll tell you why it's not the case. But when you look at the instrumented sternum or the muscles around the spine, we always ensure that the brace will fail before the structure underneath the brace is injured. So the brace is designed to fracture at a certain point. Both the front of the brace and the thoracic member, the strut in the brace, will fail before the injury threshold. And it fails well before. At 20% of the magnitude required to produce an injury to the back, for example, the thoracic member would have failed. So the brace is designed to be in the right place at the right time for a head strike. But if the magnitude is going to be large enough to cause an injury to the body structures, the brace will fail. But by the time the brace has failed, that amount of energy required to break the brace has already been removed from the system. So in all scenarios, the energy transference is done in a safe way, and the brace will always fail before the body structure is injured. I mentioned just now the collarbone, and a really interesting question to ask when people say, well, I broke my collarbone and the brace was responsible. And in fact, this was borne out in the EMS study, which we can perhaps discuss a little later. That's not the case. If you consider that the collarbone is like a tripod and it's there to support the shoulder, and it's there to fail before the shoulder does, because a collarbone is going to heal a lot quicker than the shoulder is. If you fall on an outstretched arm, the force is going to go up the arm and break the collarbone in preference to the shoulder. And if you fall on your shoulder, the collarbone is going to break in preference to the shoulder. So it heals quicker, and it's the body is a fantastically marvelous thing. We're always amazed at it, that it has this built-in crumple zone, if you like, where the collarbone will fail. So if somebody falls, for example, wearing a neck brace and a helmet on their left shoulder and their collarbone breaks, well, if it was the left-hand side collarbone that broke, it can't be the brace, because in that scenario, the head would have gone to the right. And if the head had anything to do with striking the brace and forcing the brace into the collarbone, well, the injury has just occurred on the wrong side. So it's the side on which you fall produces the injury. Then it's the fall itself that's produced that injury. Another interesting way to look at it is that if the brace was responsible, the collarbone fractures that we see would all be depressed fractures. The collarbone would be depressed downwards rather than the typical fractures seen in a bicycle or motorcycle accident. And that's not the case in the collarbone injuries we see. So the EMS study and our instrumented dummy, which has a collarbone, all shows a reduction in collarbone injuries. So it's one thing to understand why there wouldn't be an increase from what I've just described, but why there would be a reduction in neck injuries. And that's because the neck brace has a collarbone cutout. And if your head is forced in one direction and impacts the brace actually shields the collarbone from the helmet rim. And although this is not the biggest culprit in terms of collarbone injuries in bicycle and motorcycle falls, you're saving the helmet rim strike, and actually that is what produces the reduction in collarbone injuries with the brace on.
Okay. Okay. So it's it's an all-round beneficial system then, I guess. It's always going to absorb energy and take energy out of the incident. Cool. So how was it received then once you launched it?
Well, you know, we had a lot of interest in South Africa. Obviously, you know, many people heard that we were producing and working on this product. So, you know, initially we sold a lot of braces in Cape Town to motorcyclists. And that was, I guess, low-hanging fruit because, you know, it was in their backyard, so to speak, and people could come into the factory and we could explain to them how the brace worked and what the thesis was, and we could fit them to make sure it was fitting them properly, and so that was easy. I then made a few trips to the US, which is obviously, you know, the home of motocross and probably the single biggest market, to try and set up some distribution once we were in production. And I find it incredibly difficult to do. There just weren't a lot of people interested, although I'd made as many contacts as I could before I went. And so what we found is just really passionate people who would sell the brace. And a gentleman by the name of Jeff Patterson was very inspired by the brace. And he helped us set up distribution in the beginning for Liat USA. And he was instrumental in getting a brace to David Bailey, the 80s motocross star, who is in a wheelchair as a result of a thoracic spine injury. And, you know, we really battled in the beginning. This is in 2007 to gain some real traction in terms of brace sales, until David Bailey went viral with a video and called on all the riders at the time to wear this product because he believed that it would reduce the number of catastrophic neck injuries in the sport that he loved. And all of a sudden, you know, neck brace sales just blew up in the USA. We went from very low volume to very high volume. I remember my wife, who we'd set up a PayPal account, came to me one morning and said, "There's something wrong. I'm getting repeat orders." You know, we went from sort of 5 orders a day to, you know, 1,500, and there was something clearly wrong. Well, those were real orders, and it was thanks to David Bailey. And I'd never met him, didn't know him quite frankly, and we had no warning that he was going to do this video. So it caught us all by surprise. And made us you know, take this business seriously, and I guess gave us the big push we required to produce a product in a factory environment where we could do it in high volume and high quality.
Yeah, and how did it find its way from motorbikes and motocross into the mountain bike world?
I guess It was a natural progression, and if you look at particularly downhill, where, you know, the falls are as dramatic as motorcycle falls, it made sense. I mean, you know, when you're going at that speed with the distinct possibility of going over the handlebars headfirst into the ground, I think it was a natural progression. And of course, you know, the number of injuries, they seem to come and go in groups. So there are no injuries for a while, and there are a number of catastrophic injuries, and then everybody grapples with this, a solution to the problem, and the brace was obviously a solution to the problem.
Yeah, definitely. And been a good few riders kind of supporting it and riding in it. What's the kind of feedback you get from those guys that are using it?
So, I mean, I think they're two distinct groups. The people who are who would never ride a motorbike or a bicycle without it, because they understand the functioning of the brace and they want the protection. And then there are those who don't understand the biomechanics, or somebody has told them it's you know, cruciatural movement, or it's not a good idea, or it's going to cause other injuries, you know, collarbone injuries, or it'll break your back. So the sort of negative publicity puts people off. And I guess in addition to those two groups, there's, you know, sort of the cool factor. Is it cool to wear a neck brace or not? When it first became commonplace in motorcycle racing in motocross and supercross in the States, it was a cool thing to have. And then for various reasons, people started taking the neck brace off, and you know, maybe it lost a bit of its cool factor. But it's really interesting to understand why people don't wear neck brace, and the psychology behind wearing or not wearing a neck brace, because it's of course a product that you can at this point in time choose to wear or not wear. Whereas if you're going to participate in a DH race, or you're going to participate in a supercross race, you don't have a choice. You have to wear a helmet, you have to wear goggles, you have to wear gloves, you have to wear a boot. So those are you know, passive protection elements that you have to wear. You're told to wear them and you don't have a choice. Whereas the neck brace, you have a choice. And when you really drill down and look at the reasoning behind not wearing a neck brace, you know, the results are often quite interesting. So, you know, in the beginning, there's no doubt that our neck brace was not as ergonomic and as adjustable and well styled as it is today. So if I look at an early adventure brace and I look at the 5.5 neck brace, there's a big difference in terms of comfort and adjustability. So I think we've listened to that component of the market. A well-adjusted brace, in excess of 95% of people can wear it, because it doesn't interfere with their riding. Certain people who have very short necks or of a particular build are going to find it difficult to wear, just like certain people find it difficult to find a helmet that fits them properly or a boot that fits them properly. You know, the human body is quite different and sometimes a challenge, and manufacturers will of course manufacture sizing for the majority of the market. So I think we've spoken to the fitment issues that people are addressed right in the beginning, and there's no doubt that a well-adjusted 5.5 neck brace will be not only comfortable, but won't restrict a rider of any level, whether they're a professional like Marvin Muskin or whether they're an amateur. It's completely usable and rideable. I think there's also another dynamic, and that is, you know, the sense of restriction. So if you look at the progression from the braces that were launched, you know, 10 years ago to the 5.5, they definitely fit better and are more adjustable to the rider. But when you try a brace on in a shop and it's not set up properly yet, and you put your head back and you can feel the brace, some people perceive that as a restriction in movement. But it's not really a restriction of movement. It's at an extreme range of movement that you're feeling the brace. And that just means that the brace is there ready to do what it needs to do if you have an accident. So the fact that you can actually feel the brace at an extreme movement is a positive thing. It doesn't mean you're going to have restriction of movement. And if you look at the quantity and the caliber of pro riders in DH and motocross, supercross that wear the brace, it shows you that, you know, no matter what level of rider you are, if you have a properly adjusted neck brace on, of a current design is completely wearable.
Yeah, for sure. Does the interaction between the helmet and the brace, obviously that's important. Does it vary between different helmet brands and shell types, like the way the two interact?
It does. And we give a reference range of the gap between the helmet and the brace that we advise is the correct range between the helmet and the neck brace. And helmet designs have also changed over the years. And we found a trend which thankfully is reversing now, is to have helmets where the lower rear component of the helmet had rearward extensions and projections that made it incredibly difficult to wear a neck brace because the helmets were not of a typical design that we'd used when we developed the neck brace. But fortunately, those really odd shapes and rearward projections are not commonplace in modern helmets. But if you're going to set up a brace properly, you know, it makes sense to make sure that your helmet is compatible, or that the range of movement that you require for your type of riding style is adequate. But as I mentioned, if you look at the caliber of riders that are able to ride with a neck brace, and the adjustability that we have now, there's nothing stopping anybody within that sort of 95% of body types from wearing a neck brace.
Cool. And what have you seen back in kind of real world data stuff? Because obviously you can't really just go and get real life humans and throw them on the ground to test this product. But you mentioned an EMS report, I think, that you'd had back on some stuff.
So there are a number of studies, and these are available under the Liat Lab tab on our website as a reference, together with a lot of other testing. So if any of the listeners want to delve deeper into the test results and the real science behind the brace, they are there. But the testing up until recently has been trying to find some kind of surrogate for a human to test the brace on. As you say, we can't really ethically drop people on their heads with a brace on. But what we can do is use similar to human surrogates, whether they're computer models that have been validated by cadaver testing, or they are generally accepted physical models that are used in the automotive industry and can be shown to be used in compression. And that's really been what we've tested the brace on, and it really is a no-brainer. I mean, if you see the results with and without the brace on, you'll be very hard placed to justify not riding with a neck brace on if you're doing a sport or a pastime where there's a risk of a neck injury. We recently have been delighted to see the release of the EMS Action Sports study from the USA, which has almost 10,000 riders and almost 10 years worth of research. So this group of trackside paramedics put together results from their data collection of patients at the trackside at various states in the USA over a 10-year period. And they looked at people who were wearing a neck brace and those who weren't. And the results are dramatic, even better than we had anticipated. In the region of an 89% reduction in neck injuries wearing a brace versus not wearing a brace. If you look at the data for helmets, seatbelts, airbags, this is a very good result. It means that the neck brace is effective. Not only is the neck brace effective, but it's also not at the risk of other injuries. So it wasn't seen with an increase in other injury types. And in fact, like we just discussed, the collarbone, it was actually a reduction in collarbone injuries rather than an increase in collarbone injuries, which I think most people were surprised by. But understanding the science was not surprising.
Good stuff. So you must be pretty happy then. A thought that you had, is it 15 years ago now, to see that kind of validated, I guess, in data from people and improving those lives, that must feel pretty good.
It does. I think you used the word validated. It validates sort of a lifetime's worth of work. And it, you know, the in looking at statistics and the reduction in neck injuries as indicated by the study, there are a lot of people who are not in wheelchairs because of the brace, and there are a lot of people that are alive because of the brace. And that was, you know, the design rationale right in the beginnings, to decrease the incidence of catastrophic neck injuries with a brace on. It's a great feeling, we're now even more driven to use our sort of design methodology to look at other body areas now, and hopefully shape the injuries that are seen in our sport and reduce them over time. This is one other topic in terms of studies that we've seen. So one of the other interesting studies, which can be found on our website, the UNISTRA study, used a dynamic finite element analysis model. So that's a long word for a computer model that we use to test the neck brace. And the way this model is developed is to look at human modeling and using real data from humans and cadavers to build a model and validate the model. And essentially, the brain, the skull, the vertebra of the neck are built in tiny little components. Say, for example, 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter. And then they join together in a sense where the boundary conditions between these little 1 millimeter blocks are known and validated against real-life human models. So that if you impact something or you put a force on it and it distorts, it behaves the same way as a human does. And this model is a very complex model and has been used for biomechanical research and has taken more than a decade to develop. And it's been validated. In other words, if you test something on a human, you'll get the same results with this computer model as you would if you were doing on a human. And an example, there's a knee implant or a spinal implant, for example. So we took this model and we put a neck brace on it and a helmet, and we impacted it in the same way as we've done in various other testing. And what it showed is not only a reduction in neck forces, but also a reduction in head forces. And we've thought that this was the case for some time, but needed the right model to prove it. Of course, concussions and serious head injuries are part and parcel of our sports, downhill and motocross riding. And so if we can reduce head injuries as well as neck injuries by using a neck brace, well, that's even better. And the reason for the reduction that we've seen in head injury data with the neck brace is because if you fall over handlebars, for example, and land on the ground, you're taking a head that's traveling at speed and it's hitting the ground and stopping in a very short space of time. It's decelerating. But then the head begins to move again. So it then moves relative to the torso, to the rest of the body. So a head that is in line with the body initially is going to whip back or whip sideways. So it comes to a stop, it decelerates, it then very rapidly accelerates again, and then it gets to the point where it stops against the rest of the body. So you'll be surprised to see on impact videos how far the head will travel if it's not constrained by a neck brace. And we found that if you can catch the head earlier in its, for example, if the head is knocked backwards, early in its rearward extension cycle, that actually the amount of acceleration the head gains in a secondary part of the impact is less. And so the total impact to the brain, so to speak, is reduced. And this is very encouraging for future studies, and to see that to determine whether we're going to actually see a reduction in concussions and brain injuries by using a neck brace. But the data seems to certainly point in that direction.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Yeah, I'd not heard about that yet. That's very cool. So let's talk a little bit about helmets, because there's been a lot of noise in the press about it recently. There's been some new innovations from some companies and a lot more kind of progression, I guess, and debate around helmet technology than we've seen for a number of years. What's your philosophy on helmet design? How have you approached it?
So helmets are one of those devices that for a long time remained pretty static. There wasn't a lot of evolution in terms of technology. And then all of a sudden, we've seen this real evolvement in terms of testing and new innovations that have been included in helmets. And as we were a fairly late player to the market in terms of helmets, first with the neck brace and the helmet came thereafter, we've, in the sort of wave of progressive helmet design thinking, I believe. And so, like with a neck brace or our knee braces or any of our protective apparel, we would like to produce a helmet that is as effective as possible in reducing head injuries. The interesting thing to understand about helmet test standards, which is, I guess, the way a lot of helmet manufacturers will approach designing a helmet, whether it's Snell, DOT, ECE, FIM now, whichever standard is used, there's a barrier to entry. Your helmet has to perform at a certain level in a certain type of impact to be able to pass the standard. If you can't pass the standard, you can't sell your helmet. And so I think the standards have been a way in which many manufacturers have approached helmet design in the past. But particularly a topical issue at the moment, for example, in the USA, in the National Football League, is just the quantum of significant concussions and head injuries that are occurring in that sport. And a realization really that, banging your head really hard in a single impact is one thing, but multiple impacts or an impact of a perhaps a smaller size, but from an angle that creates rotational acceleration on the helmet, may be actually more devastating to the rider over a period of time. And so this sort of understanding has led to new technology being developed. And I think new standards. So there's a new proposed FIM standard for motorcycle helmets that's been adopted for road racing, and I'm sure we'll see it adopted for off-road riding environment in the future, where you now not only have to produce a helmet that is effective in reducing linear deceleration, in other words, the head going in and moving in one direction, but also rotational acceleration. And so the industry is changing. And the progression, I think, is very exciting. And the likes of MIPS and others that have now come into the industry with devices that allow for rotational acceleration mitigation, reduction in rotational acceleration, are making a real difference to the severity and the quantity of head injuries we're seeing in our sport. And so we're not the kind of company that just produces a product to enter a particular market category. We want to do it better if possible. And we sit and are involved with as many standard developments as possible. The head injury and helmet standards have been around for a long time, and they're more approachable. There isn't as yet a neck injury standard. But being close to the development of standards and sort of the cutting edge allows us to work on helmet designs. And I think you'll see a lot of progressive innovation in the helmet space. If I just look at the IP registrations in the space at the moment, there's a lot of new work going on. So our approach was to produce a safe helmet, safe in terms of being well within the prescribed force transduction in the helmet standards, but also make a helmet that is good for low-speed linear damping, good for rotational acceleration. And that's why we developed the turbine in our helmet, which is both there to reduce slow or repeated low-speed impacts, as well as rotational acceleration. And although they're not part of the test standard at the moment, I foresee that in the future they will become part of part of the test standard. So it's an exciting place to be. I think there's a lot of innovation at the moment. And ultimately, it shouldn't be around producing a helmet to withstand a certain impact on a certain place at a certain impact velocity. It should really be about producing a helmet that is as safe as possible. And I think with the progression of standards and understanding now, we are actually seeing helmets that are going to become safer and safer for the end user.
Yeah, it's great stuff. We definitely need more of that. Cool. So what's next for Lear then? Are there things that you're working on that you can tell us about, or is it kind of just iterative improvements to current product?
Well, you know, we're always innovating. we pride ourselves on our core focus being to innovate and really apply science to protective apparel. Our sort of catchphrase is the science of the thrill. And so I think there are a lot of product categories that we're working on. So some of them I can talk about, some of them I can't talk about. We've launched our goggles now, which are bulletproof, gives the rider confidence to ride in roost. We've produced a very safe helmet, and so there will be iterative steps. We've won awards for a lot of our products. We've got, I think, really innovative gloves and very innovative riding apparel. Soft and hard shell protection is very comfortable, very user-friendly, but also an example of where we've looked at actually going to the industry, particularly in the US, where there were no levels prescribed for hard and soft shell protectors for the body, and introduced ECE levels to the US market, where we will tell you how much force is going to be removed or what level and standard our chest protectors and body armor are going to function at. So, that's another innovation. It's not a, in inverted commas, a Me Too product, but a product where we really apply our minds to producing a product that's as good as we can make it, that really changes the safety of our sport and hopefully is cool and approachable for our clientele. And the process continues. I've just stepped out of a very exciting workshop where we're looking at new products. As I say, I can't talk to all of them now, but there's some very, very exciting projects that we're working on. And also the people in our company, we have a very flat management structure and a really great team that comprise people of various backgrounds, from biomedical engineering, design work. But one of the common threads is that a large percentage of our company rides. So we're not producing products that are sort of ticking off an Excel spreadsheet of product categories, but it's something that we really believe in. And most of us being riders are able to add to that product mix and generate new products. I've just finished the APSA Cape Epic, and it was a unique opportunity to really do a very, very tough race with Lear products on, and to see what everybody else is riding with, and to see what we think should be introduced to that industry to make our sport more pleasurable and safer.
Good stuff. Yeah, exciting times. We look forward to seeing what else comes out of the Lear stable over the coming years. We're getting close to the end of our time. We've got our three questions, so we'll go through those if that's all right.
Absolutely.
Good stuff. The first one of those is, if our listeners had £150, which I think is about 2,800 rand, mm-hmm. To spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
So that's a great question. And I thought about it a lot. And actually, the more I thought about it, the easier the answer to that question was. So, when I decided to do the Cape Epic, which is an extremely tough 8-day extreme mountain bike race, what really influenced my performance is getting a good trainer. So I actually spent my time and effort on myself. And I think, you know, some of the bicycles and motorcycles now are so good and so able to perform tasks. I would spend my money on my own performance. And by getting a really good trainer, it absolutely dramatically changed my riding and allowed us to perform really well in a tough race. So I would spend my money on a trainer.
Good stuff. Yeah, you survived. So that's it's got to have been worth it. All right. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself, age 16, what advice would you give him?
You know, there's another interesting question. I'm not sure I would want to go back and mess with my mojo at all. I'm quite pleased with how my life has progressed. You know, obviously there's some very tough times in one's life, but I think that shapes you. And also knowing the outcome may deter the enthusiasm, because the amount of energy and sheer grit and determination it took to get the company up and running, you know, is born out of your desire not to fail and your desire to succeed. And I guess my only real advice was, do what you're passionate about. I've said it to my children, and that's what I firmly believe in. Don't worry about money. Don't worry about fame. Worry about what you are really passionate about, and everything else will follow.
Good advice. Yeah, I like that a lot. And then the last of the three questions, if you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be?
Another question I thought a lot about, and I think my problem with answering that question is that there are various elements in my life and various components to my life, all of which, you know, I continuously seek to improve. So I don't believe there's any one person that I would go to. What I try and focus my life on is you know, going to people that I respect and learning from them. And when I started this business, I knew very little about many elements and aspects of it. So I asked a huge amount of questions and then distilled what worked for me out of all the answers. So I think it's more about informing yourself of what other people are doing rather than single advice from one person. I think I was very lucky to get a lot of good advice from a lot of people from very varied components, whether they be engineering or mechanical to finance and all the others. So I hope I haven't dodged your question.
Well, I guess your summary is, don't be afraid to ask. Yeah, find good people that are doing it well and ask them.
Ask.
Yeah, good stuff. All right. If people want to find out more about Liat, where should they head?
So www.liat.com is our website. Obviously, we're on social media, and on our website, you'll find the product-related component to the site, and then obviously the part that I'm interested in is the science. And if you go to the Liat Lab tab on our website, you'll see a plethora of information there about the testing we've done to date, the EMS Action Sports Study, the UNISTRA study. And I think we're quite unique in the fact that if we produce a significant product like the neck brace or a knee brace, is that we produce a white paper on the whole development process. The thesis, the methodology, the testing, the results, the conclusions that we came to is all written up, because we've always believed that information is power, and our customers should have the ability to make a really informed decision.
Good stuff. Yeah, there's plenty of things there for people to go away and read and get more detail on. So, yeah, we'll put links in the show notes over to the website so people can find that there.
Great.
All right, good stuff. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Chris. It's been really interesting chatting and finding out about more about you and about where Liat's heading. So, yeah, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks for taking interest in our company.
No worries. Cheers.
Go well. Bye-bye.
Right, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed learning more about Chris and the Liat brace. Head to liat.com and check out their braces, helmets, and a whole host of other great products. It's leat.com. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media, subscribe to the podcast so you can get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to get yourself some exclusive Downtime Podcast goodies, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. Please keep telling your friends about the podcast and spreading the word. We only exist because of everyone who shared what we're doing with their riding friends and supported us along the way. So a massive thank you to all of you who've helped out so far. Right, I'm off up to Fort William for the World Cup to find you guys some more guests, and we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.